I didn't know Aquaman was here today.
You know, when you go into his office, you can hear the ocean.
Good afternoon, everyone. I would be more than happy to welcome you all to the House Committee on Transportation and Economic Development this February 22nd, 2016. We've opened the curtains because it's a beautiful day in Salem, and we are in this building for long hours during the day. And if you don't all mind, we'd like to have a little glimmer of sunshine just to cheer us all up a little bit. I think Representative Nierman, would you like to come and join us at the dais? We would be more than happy to have you come sit with us. I think Representative Hack's seat next to Representative Lively, but one over would be just fine. Thank you. Our first order of business is an informational meeting today.
Did you want to do the informational first? Yes. Madam Chair, why am I questioning you, Madam Chair?
How about that?
Wow.
Okay.
Since we have Representative Nierman here, I think it would be appropriate to deal with his issue.
That does make sense.
And I will open an informational hearing on the road usage charge ORGO program status report. And Mr. Brower, my apologies to you. We've been trying to get you here since, I believe, last November, and we've had a number of scheduling issues, and you've been kind enough to allow us to delay you more than once. And so I appreciate your patience and look forward to hearing a little bit about what's happening with our road usage charge pilot program. Welcome to our committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thanks for having me here today. And absolutely no problem to delay us. We're always fine coming whenever you have the time for us.
Thank you.
So I'm here to give you an update on the ORGO Road Usage Charge Program that launched back on July 1st of 2015. We successfully launched that program. As you may recall, it was a product of SB 810 from the 2013 legislative session. The basic contours that were set in SB 810 is that we're up to 5,000 vehicles for this voluntary program with a per-mile road usage charge set at 1.5 cents per mile, equivalent to the gas tax on the average fuel-efficient vehicle. Fuel tax was treated as a credit for prepayment of the road usage charge. The legislation directed us to provide mileage reporting choices to a variety of through a variety of account managers, and GPS was not required. That's an important distinction that we wanted to ensure that there were opportunities for people to choose between different technologies that would ensure that privacy was fully protected. As part of that, we contracted with three private sector firms to provide account management to volunteers in the program. The three that came forward through that competitive process were Azuga, Sanef, which partnered with ODOT to serve as the ODOT account manager, essentially standing in for ODOT as the government option in this case, and Verizon Telematics, which offered a program through its existing InDrive partnership with an insurance company. The volunteer experience was relatively easy for folks to sign up. Unless you were like me and you forgot all the information you needed in your car and had to go out to it three times, it takes about 5 minutes to go get the information, your VIN, your mileage, and your license plate number. And then you choose an account manager, and then you sign up through the website. Relatively easy. The sign-up process is very seamless. Then after selecting an account manager, you get a mileage reporting device in the mail, and installation takes about 30 seconds. Or if you're me, it takes about a minute because you can't find the little OBD2 port. But really very seamless process, very easy for people to sign up. And then once you do that, all you have to do is drive. It's really very easy for the customers to take part in this. In terms of the payment process and the account settlement, it differs by the different account managers. They have slightly different approaches here. So, for example, the nature of the billing, the payment, the method of payment is all a little bit different depending on your account manager. Azuga, for example, has a prepaid wallet online where you can add funds and then it just automatically subtracts from there. The ODOT account manager, they bill quarterly when that amount reaches $20. So each of these just gives people different options depending on how they want to pay for their mileage. We've been closely tracking the volunteers by account managers. As you can see here, Azuga, one of our private sector firms, has the most. They've had 522 signed up as of last week. That's interesting to note because most people have chosen the GPS options in this. Only about a quarter of the folks have gone with the non-GPS option. Mm-hmm. And I think that's because it does offer some additional benefits. For example, it should not charge you for out-of-state miles, although occasionally that can be a little bit of a rough spot from what I hear. The other thing to note is that our volunteers come from a variety of types of fuel-efficient vehicles. So we thought going into this that we might have a hard time signing up the more fuel-efficient vehicles, but darned if about half of our vehicles are in the more fuel-efficient category, and so we're actually getting a large number of folks who may have to pay a little bit more under Orego, but have decided they think it's worth it to try out the system and help us take it for a test drive. On that front, the most enrolled vehicle in the program, oddly enough, is a Prius, and I have my Prius in the program, so there are quite a number of Priuses in. The second most enrolled is the Subaru Outback, and the third is the Ford F-150. So,
really?
To me, these are sort of like the quintessentially Oregonian vehicles.
Wow, that's
Can't
interesting.
Get much more Oregon than that. Vehicles. So, you know, we've been closely watching the number of folks that are participating in the pilot, and what we've got a 1,005, I believe, as of last week. We asked our quality assurance firm, Public Knowledge, which provided quality assurance over the project as we went through that process, whether they viewed that that was a number that was able to test the system, and they came back and said that based on their analysis that absolutely the number of vehicles we have in the system is adequate to test the system to make sure it works. We have been able to use that number of vehicles to find bugs. We have, right at the moment, over 200 vehicle models that have participated in it at some point. So that's really important to get a wide variety of vehicle types in because you get some different situations depending on the manufacturer, the model of the vehicle, and depending on just some of the basics of the way the machines interact with the system. But overall, the system has worked very well. You know, we've been able to find some bugs. Getting these things figured out in a pilot phase has been very important so that we can continue to improve the system over time. And we've already made quite a number of updates to our base system here. I use the analogy of, you know, an opinion poll where here we have 1,000 vehicles out of, you know, admittedly, you know, over 3 million vehicles in Oregon. So people have said, is that really enough to be able to generalize to the population? And I think it's much like you can poll 500 Oregonians and get a pretty good statistically valid sampling of what the statewide opinion is on any topic. So I think that similarly, our size of the sample here is adequate to test that as well. You know, we're also going to be closely watching public opinion on this. We've obviously had a lot of interest in the program, and we're going to be doing some continued survey research as part of our ongoing efforts just to test what public opinion thinks, see if we're moving the needle at all on the understanding of our transportation funding challenges and potential support and buy-in from the public. Because just based on, it's hard to judge public support based on the number of people who wake up one morning and say, hey, I think I'll sign up for a new tax program. It doesn't necessarily translate.
Top of the list.
On that front, you know, we have seen, though, that our volunteers are generally very satisfied. Our public knowledge, our quality assurance firm, did a survey of our volunteers late last fall, and what they found was that 93% of them gave it either an excellent, good, or okay rating. Only 7% came in at poor or very poor. So we're going to be continuing to talk with our volunteers on a regular basis. We do exit surveys when people leave the program so that we know what is on their mind or what sort of issues that may have popped up. Right to date, we have a retention rate of about 90%, which is good considering we really, in making the pitch to the public, only asked for a test drive. Take it out for a spin, a few months, see if you like it. We really didn't ask anybody for any sort of length of commitment to this particular program. So the tax reports are in. We actually have money in the bank from this program now, which is good to say in a sense that we are the first state in the nation really to ever have collected a per mile road usage charge. So it is a real live operational system. California is going to be turning on a system later in the year. They are not doing it with real money. They are doing it with just sort of illustrative billing. And so this is, we are a step ahead in that sense. You have built a real system here that is fully scalable and can actually collect a tax. We've had continuing ongoing national interest and support for the program. One of the things that was heartening was the National Association of State Chief Information Officers gave this project a award as the top project in the area of emerging and innovative technology recently. So that was very nice to get that support. We've had a lot of national media. We had a reporter from the Pew Trust State Line program out last year. And then this, we've got a few covers of reports that have endorsed per mile road usage charges. This, in within the transportation world, is being watched very highly. A lot of anticipation about what we're finding, what we're doing, and other states that are looking at following us. There is as close to a consensus among transportation wonks around moving toward a per mile road usage charge as there is on just about any topic. So there is a lot of interest in this, and so just a little bit of pressure on us to do this well and succeed and help the country understand where this could go. So in terms of what's next for the Origo program, you heard me mention that California is going to be turning on a system a little bit later this year. They're going to be using a very similar approach with account managers from the private sector and using a very similar system. Washington has proposed to their legislature to move in the same direction, although they are not there yet. And then there is a number of other states around the country that are very interested in a road usage charge. There is a consortium of Western states that we call the Western Road Usage Charge Consortium that we helped form and that now is moving forward under California's direction that is working on a regional basis to determine what might go forward and looking at things like, you know, regional implementation of this and just looking at some of those policy issues. So there's some strength in numbers among a number of states that are really looking at this. A number of you are on or have served on the Road User Fee Task Force, and so we will continue to engage that august body as we look toward what the future may be. This is a program that was created by the legislature with no sunset date, so it will continue going forward. But the Road User Fee Task Force may inform what the future state of this might look like, whether in the future there might be some full implementation of this for certain classes of vehicles, what a rate structure might look like, etc. So we've had ongoing meetings on that. I think the next meeting will be in May as we continue to work through some of those weighty policy issues. One last note is that the Congress recently passed the Fixing America's Surface Transportation Act, or the FAST Act, which, among many other things, provided a $95 million pool of funds for efforts to find replacements for the gas tax, looking at different user-based paying systems, which was really focused on looking at taking the road usage charge to the next level. So we're going to be looking at opportunities both within ODOT and within the Western Road Usage Charge Consortium at whether there are opportunities to continue developing our system and taking the next steps with this project, and we'll continue to work with the Road User Fee Task Force on that. So with that, I will wrap up and happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Did you say that there were 5,000 people that have gone through it? What was that first slide that had the 5,000? You said 1,005, and then was there another number at the beginning?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative McLean, the program was set up to allow for up to 5,000, the 5, cap 000. That was set by the legislature, and there were some sideboards as well about the different vehicle classes because there was concern initially that you might have only fuel-inefficient vehicles that would be getting a refund check checking into the program. So right now we had, as of last week, 1,005 in the program. We've had another nearly 100 that have been in previously and are now out of the program. They either left entirely or someone maybe got a new vehicle and switched over to that vehicle.
Thank you.
Representative Nierman, thank you for joining us today. I know you had a question or a comment.
Yeah, and thank you for inviting me to sit in on your committee. And I waffled about this, if this is the right forum to do this, because I'm not wanting to pick on ODOT or anything like that. But I did have a little problem with this. I'm a participant in the pilot, and a while back I was in Canada for several days, and at least it appears to me on my report that I was charged for some vehicle miles while I was in Canada. So I'm not wanting to make an international incident out of it.
Very wise, Representative. Thank you.
If you don't mind, I would like to share that with you if you're the appropriate person or if you can direct me to the person to show that to. So.
Yeah, Chair McEwen, Representative Nierman, absolutely. We really appreciate you bringing those cases to our attention. We are encouraging all of our volunteers to bring those things forward so that we can work out any bugs. I went up to Northern Washington one time and as soon as I got there, that was the first thing I did, was I checked to see whether my mileage had been stopped. And for me, right at the interstate bridge, that was the cutoff point. So it's interesting to find that you've had that bug. We'll get you in touch with the right people. We'll ensure that we can try to figure out what's going on there and try to get to the bottom of that.
Good. Thank you. And other than that, my experience has been very, very good with the program.
So. Good. We appreciate getting that feedback.
Questions? Yes, Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for all the work on this. The challenge, of course, has always been how, with a small number of people participating, we could let the rest of the state know. So what is being done to educate up the rest of the state about how well this works? And I think you may have mentioned it, but can you just walk down through it? Is it going out in newspapers? Are there articles being published every day? Is there, what is happening to let the rest of the state know about this?
Yeah, Chair McEwen, Representative Bentz, we have been engaged in regularly pushing information out about the program as we hit new milestones, as we roll out different features. So we're going to continue to do that. We've got, a blog. We've been posting videos. We've been sending out press releases. We've been talking with reporters, drumming up interest in the program. We're going to continue to do that, and we're going to continue to look at opportunities, particularly, I think, later this year, after we've had about a year under our belt, we're looking at sort of publishing an evaluation, a report on what the program has done, and be able to look at the good, bad, the ugly, the best parts of it, and be able to talk about where it's going. And so I think at that point will be a really good opportunity to talk to the public. But we'll continue to do that over time because it is really important to let the public know about both just the general transportation funding challenges we face, as well as what we're finding in this program.
Follow up.
Yes.
So I'm happy to hear that. I guess the question is, has polling been done or any look to see what people's perceptions of pay by the mile is? And is there a baseline that's been established to see how much of an impact the efforts you're planning on making will have on that level of public perception?
Chair McEwen, Representative Bentz, thank you for bringing that up. That was actually something I was working on this morning. We did an initial survey. Every 2 years, we do essentially a customer service survey at ODOT, what we call the Transportation Needs and Issues Survey. This last go-round, we included a series of questions about road usage charges to gauge what the public felt. There were some other issues around the gas tax and things like that. And what we found was that there was general public support. It got actually to majority support for implementing a road usage charge on the most fuel-efficient vehicles. The question was framed around the growth in fuel efficiency and the fact that there are vehicles increasingly coming onto the market that pay little or nothing. And so 51% of those surveyed said that they would be supportive of a road usage charge on those higher efficiency vehicles. It dropped off as you talked about, imposing it on all vehicles, for example, maybe not the most popular option out there. We're going to be doing that same survey again in the very near future. So we have a baseline set of data. We'll be able to look at whether we've moved the needle up or down in that regard.
Yes, sir.
Now, it would seem that as more people drive Priuses, less people would be supportive of this program. Because they all will get to pay more. So do you anticipate that we would see a slide as we move up away from enthusiasm for this, knowing that you're basically going to vote yourself a tax increase?
Chair McEwen, Representative Bentz, it's hard to say. Certainly, we are seeing more fuel-efficient vehicles on the market, but the portion of the vehicles on the road that are in that extremely fuel-efficient category of a Prius or above is still a relatively small number. So you're not by any means getting to majority status that they would outvote, you know, the rest of the market.
Thank goodness. Sorry.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Assistant Director. Appreciate it. Ms. Kraft sent the committee members a great summary of the FAST Act, I think, in December, and it included the reference to the federal competitive grant funding for funding alternatives. Part of that is $15 million in fiscal year 2016 and $20 million each year after that. Does ODET anticipate making a competitive grant proposal for this year? Or what are the what do we need to do to set ourselves up? Because if this is a program that doesn't look as though this legislature is going to eliminate it, so it's going to be here at least for another year until 17. If we have the opportunity to receive assistance from the federal government, it seems like we should take it.
Yeah. Chairman Kuhn, Representative Davis, that's absolutely correct. We are have started those discussions internally about what it might be that we might apply for, whether it's upgrades to our existing system or working with neighboring states on working through some of the issues around regionalism and how you do it on a multi-state level. So we're already starting to think about what the scope, schedule, and budget of applications might look like and trying to determine, especially if there are elements that we currently have in our work plan that we would already have budget set aside for that we might be able to get the federal government to pay a portion of. So we absolutely are taking a look at that because, you know, Director Garrett has indicated to all of us that he does not want to go flat-footed on this. He wants to continue to look to the future as to where we go with this program and see if there are ways to continue building on our successes to date.
Yes.
And if I could make a suggestion to follow up on Representative Benz's comment, perhaps a funding for some sort of grant or marketing opportunity where we've got this delta of 4,000 more spots to be filled, and the data that could be gathered from those 4,000 drivers would be valuable really to every state in the nation, which it seems to me is the goal of Congress in passing the FAST Act.
Yeah, Representative McKeown, Representative Davis, one of the components that is eligible under the FAST Act grants is for public outreach. And so we are putting together a potential essential module on public outreach that we might fold into a grant to be able to both hopefully get a better sense of where the public is on this and talk to them about it and potentially also bring more people into the program.
One more follow-up.
Yes, sir.
Well, and if there's anything we can do as committee members to, when that grant is ready to submit to the federal government, we'd be happy to lend our support, or at least I would. I suppose I see
nods.
Well, I'll throw Rep Benson there. Sure.
No. He's the only one not nodding, I think. Yes.
Anybody else not nodding?
He's the only one that didn't.
And Nierman. Representative Nierman in particular. He's on the diet. He's ready to go. Three of us. Anybody else out there?
Chair McHugh, Representative Davis, this, depending on the timing of the grant, we may very well bring this forward in front of the Road User Fee Task Force and allow them to provide some feedback and potentially put a stamp of approval on it as well.
Thank you.
Thank you. And you've covered most of my questions, follow-up from my esteemed colleagues, but I do have a couple more. What's the geographic distribution of the 1,005 people that have signed up at this point in time?
Representative McHugh, we have pretty good geographical distribution. There are some counties in the state where we don't have volunteers, but when I last ran the numbers, counties representing 98% of Oregon's population were included in the program. So,
Representative Benz,
urban and
we need
rural.
Some work now.
I believe we do have one participant in Malheur County. So we do have wide geographic distribution. We're going to continue to work to ensure that we get this message out to all corners of the state so that this isn't seen as an urban or rural program. Interestingly, one of the notes in our research to date was there was actually stronger support in rural areas for putting in place a road usage charge on high-efficiency vehicles. So we're going to continue to look at some of those interesting variables as well. But we do have pretty good geographic spread.
Good. Thank you. And you have three vendors, and you have a fairly decent distribution between the three. Do you have some sense as to why a particular car owner would select a particular vendor? Are you getting a sense of how that works? And I'm just intrigued that F-150s are a large part of the mix. That's fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
It's heartening, I guess I should say.
Chair McEwen, it's hard to say what anyone signs up for any given vendor. But, you know, I, for example, signed up for Azuga, which is one of the GPS-based providers, in part because I do have family in northern Washington State and didn't really want to pay for those miles. So in that sense, you know, with the GPS, you don't have to pay for out-of-state miles up front. For the non-GPS device, you can get refunded that, but then you have to fill out a form and, you know, go through that process. You know, one other thing that's interesting too, and I brought out my iPhone just to show you, if you want to pay for your road usage charge now on your iPhone, there's an app for that. Azuga has actually put out a app that allows you to track your mileage. It tells me my driving score based on my acceleration, my speeding, my braking and idling, and allows you to tell where your car is at any time. It allows you to put up geofences. I joked at a conference the other day, I'm to put one up for my wife's vehicle around Nordstrom, so maybe I can go cancel her card if too much damage gets done. But it allows you to do all sorts of things to actually connect with your vehicle. So we sort of view this as it's an interesting application for where this program might go in the future as one part of a suite of mobility services, and that it would be sort of a value-added thing. One of our account managers is actually looking to bring in a new device they have that is a device that is a pay-by-the-month service that they would just add road usage charge as one of the services they provide. And so we're looking at this, it's sort of it's an interesting model of engaging the private sector. You never know what you're going to get, but you can certainly find some innovation there.
Could you go back a couple of slides to the beginning where you showed the device being attached right there?
Yep.
And what was that called?
It's called a mileage reporting device. Otherwise,
I mean the port.
Oh, that's the OBD2 port, the onboard diagnostic port.
Okay.
This is actually, I believe that the primary purpose is actually to check emissions and some other things on a vehicle.
They do.
So this is one that your local repair shop would know where it is, but can your, the average layperson find that?
Yes, as the average layperson, Chair McEwen, I can assure you, my knowledge of cars does not go very deep.
Right.
And so, yes, it did take me long. It maybe took me a minute, and I had to get out my flashlight in my minivan and get down on the floor. But it's just
not
right
difficult.
There.
Not difficult.
No, very easy for most folks.
All right. Let's see. What else did I have? Well, I am one of those unfortunate souls who has been intending to sign up for this program now for 6 months. I keep walking away from my car and not getting my mileage. And I will pledge today in this committee that I will be doing that by the end of the week. I've been trying to do it for a long time, and I keep walking away without getting my mileage. So that is something that I'm interested in helping out with. Any other questions? I'm just intrigued by this. Yes.
One question, Madam Chair.
Yes. Mr. Brennan, please.
So I, when you gave this presentation before, I remember this question and have not remembered to ask it since. So the program is limited to 5,000 vehicle participants, and there are about 100, you said, that have started participation and dropped off. Did I hear that correctly?
Chair McEwen, yes, there is, I can't remember the exact number, but we're at 90% retention rate and have 1,000 vehicles in, so it's somewhere around 100 have left the program, or in some of those cases brought a new vehicle in. But it's tracked by vehicles, not number of drivers.
Yes, Mr. Brennan.
That was what I was wondering. Is so the vehicles that have dropped out of the program, do those count against the 5,000 still?
I believe that it's active participants.
Okay.
So we may actually have a larger, we will have a larger number than simply the number of people in at any time.
Okay. Could you forward a slide? Keep going. Right there. I was intrigued as this has unfolded over the last 3 or 4 years that I've actually been kind of keeping an eye on it, that there was a significant amount of concern around the kind of the privacy issue of using the GPS device. But it looks to me as though Azuga is the manager or the vendor that actually provides the GPS device, and it looks like you're getting a significant amount of interest in that. If you were the Santa for the Verizon, are those the two where you would not be using a GPS and you report mileage by taking the numbers off your odometer?
Yeah, Chair McEwen, Santa is the non-GPS device that's required in SB 810 that is it actually does count the number of miles. The only thing that it uses GPS for, the other ones use GPS for, is to determine whether you're in state or out of state, and for, you know, being able to tell you where your car is, for example, in the Azuga app. So in that sense, it, from the mileage or from the OBD2 device, it's gathering the same information. GPS is just sort of used to put you in state, out of state, and for a couple other things.
Yes. Vice Chair Gorsuch.
Okay, now I have a question that may be very questionable. However, first off, is there a firewall between the OSP and your app? That's a joke. Never mind. Well, you don't want them to just ship it over to the state police. But what is to prevent someone from unplugging the device for a period of time and then plugging it back in? Does the system know that's going on?
Chair McEwen, Vice Chair Gorsuch, yeah, absolutely. One thing I should note is that information, you know, when I look at my app, that data is not provided to ODOT. That's just with the account manager. So obviously some people have concerns about, you know, the private sector having that information, but it is not in the public sector hands. And there were very strong privacy protections put in place as to how that data derived from this program could be used, such that, you know, even the ACLU raised no objections once it came to the committee. Now, in terms, can you remind me what your second question was?
Just whether you could unplug it for a period of time and if the system would know that.
Like rolling your odometer back.
Exactly.
Like in the old days.
Right, yeah. Yep.
Yes, that is one of the challenges we have with the current mileage reporting devices. They can be unplugged. And, yes, the system does know, and it is supposed to send you a note that it has been unplugged. And there are some provisions within the regulations for how we deal with those null reporting days. However, because this is a voluntary program, we did not build extensive enforcement mechanisms in, because as you can imagine, we're not going to go, you know, slap you around if
right.
you
sure right.
when you're a volunteer.
Yeah. Yeah.
However, if this were to become a mandatory
that's
program,
what I'm thinking
we would have to work through those enforcement issues and bring that back to you in terms of a suite of enforcement options that could be included in legislation.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
You know, I find it interesting. It happens on a number of occasions that programs like this that are developed, that are innovative, people are interested in, become kind of national models, are better known outside the state than they are in the state, which often happens. So I look forward to more marketing of the program and seeing, you know, the pilot is how many more years?
Chair McEwen, there is
no sunset.
Okay. On this within the SB 810.
And I'm delighted to have a report here today. Thank you. I'm sure we'll look forward to another year down the road to see how you're doing and see if we can get those numbers up and make this a really meaningful pilot. So thank you.
Thanks.
Questions? Thank you, Representative Nearmer, for joining us today. Appreciate it.
It's really interesting.
Okay, great. I am going to... close the public hearing on, I'm sorry, the informational meeting on the road usage charge, the Origo program. And I'm going to look around, and I believe we have Representative Gomberg here today. So we're going to go out of order a bit in deference to his busy schedule and open a public hearing and a possible work session on Senate Bill 1583A. And I'll look to Mr. Brennan to enlighten us, please.
Sure, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 1583A authorizes the Office of Small Business Assistance to coordinate with and provide assistance to county municipal agencies and authorities. It authorizes the office to refer small businesses to the appropriate resources to answer questions posed by the small business. It has an emergency clause that would take effect upon signature by the governor. There's no amendment. It has minimal fiscal and no revenue impact, and came to us with a Senate floor vote of 28-0.
Thank you, Mr. Brennan. Thank you for being here this afternoon, and please, in any order you choose.
Chair McEwen, Vice Chairs, members of the committee, good afternoon. Thank you for having me. My name is Gina Zedlick. I am Senior Policy Advisor to Governor Kate Brown, and Representative Gongberg has let me go first. So.
How kind.
Representative Gongberg is deferred to the governor.
So I'm here today on behalf of the governor to submit Senate Bill 1583 to you for your consideration. As the governor has said, in support of a thriving statewide economy, she's committed to strengthening government's ability to add value to Oregon's overall economic enterprise. Essential to this effort is supporting and growing Oregon's small business sector, which fuels our economic engine. In fact, Senate Bill 1583 builds on efforts the governor first undertook as Secretary of State in 2013. With the help of key legislators, including Representative Gomberg and Representative McEwen, she proposed and the legislature approved the creation of the Office of Small Business Assistance within the Secretary of State's office. Since the office opened in January 2014, it has proved to be a great success, both in helping small businesses navigate state government regulations, but also in identifying problems to be addressed. The Secretary of State's office recently released its 2015 report. In 2015, the office helped 219 small businesses, you have it here, and nonprofits with 100 or fewer employees. This is an increase of 56% over 2014. The Small Business Advocate helped business owners with state regulatory issues, ranging from licensing to procurement. Identifying systemic problems to be solved, and of course solving them, is critical work that I think we all believe in. It can be as simple yet as meaningful as a business owner feeling like someone is in their court and willing to make a phone call, make an introduction, or ask a question on their behalf. In many instances, a small business advocate can address issues with a phone call or a simple explanation. In other cases, the advocate has been able to identify true problems, issues that involve legislative solutions or administrative rule changes. The office is able to identify these issues for the legislature or the agency, and the outcome is good for everyone, and most importantly, for Oregon's small businesses. Building on this strong track record, the governor seeks to expand the authority of this office to include local governments as well. She has learned that generally businesses view local and state regulators as one entity. In order for the government to best support small businesses, we should provide one easy point of access. Someone to call in any situation and receive guidance as to resources, information, and answers. An ombudsman that provides a one-stop shop, facilitating problem solving and adding value to Oregon's overall economic enterprise. Senate Bill 1583 expands the office in two simple yet essential ways. First, it grants the office authority to act as an advocate or ombudsman for small businesses, regardless of which area of government the business is interacting with, state agencies or local entities. Second, it mandates that the office serve as a resource to all businesses at any stage of development to maximize the many resources the legislature, agencies, and local governments already have in place. The Office of Small Business Assistance has already helped hundreds of small businesses navigate state government. Senate Bill 1583 will expand those resources to serve more and serve better Oregon's small businesses. Thank you for the opportunity to share this testimony, and I will turn it over.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm David Gomberg from the beautiful Oregon coast, and it is a beautiful day today. I think the only place that we would enjoy more than being right here today might be in Yahats, Oregon. I mention that in particular because Representative McEwen and I each share a portion of Yahats on the Central Coast. Well, I'm here today to talk about the Office of Small Business Assistance, and I was very proud to carry this bill a couple of years ago. I regard this as a success story, a success story for government and for small businesses that yearn for a place to go and solve their problems, hear their concerns, sort out the red tape and the challenges that they face on a day-to-day basis. And this program's working. The report of the Office of Small Business Assistance was issued just today, and I put a copy of the report on each of your floor desks, and I think you have a copy of that up there as well today. And there's some really very interesting information here. The most significant, I think, is that in 2014, they handled 140 cases. And in 2015, that increased by 56%, so they handled 219 cases. That's 219 businesses that had problems that called your state government and got answers for the most part. But there's a problem. And the problem is that the Office of Small Business Assistance is limited in its jurisdiction to executive branch state agencies. So if any of you recall my testimony or when I spoke on the floor of the House and carried this bill, I said, this is like small business 911. You got an emergency, you call the Office of Small Business Assistance. But imagine if you call small business 911 and you say, hi, I've got a problem with getting my food cart licensed in Portland, Oregon. Oh, sorry, we don't handle that kind of problem. And the 9/11 system hangs up. I've got a problem with personal property taxes for my business. No, sorry, we don't handle counties. I'm trying to get a pass passport to take a business trip overseas. Oh, the federal government. We can't help with that one either. We are limited to dealing with state agencies in the executive branch, but calls are coming in all the time for a variety of state government agencies. And the report that you've got there actually shows that roughly 11% of the calls that came in last year were for government levels outside of the executive branch. Now, I'm not suggesting that the office doesn't help them. I'm suggesting that they try to help them but don't have the jurisdiction to really dig in and be significant help. And that's what this bill is about here today. It says that we're going to expand the jurisdiction so that when somebody calls up with any one of a number of different kinds of problems and different levels of government, that this office can provide them with some assistance and broaden the very good work that they're already doing. It's really that simple, colleagues.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Well, I'm delighted to have this bill here. I was a chief co-sponsor of this bill in the 13th session and was delighted to work with the then Secretary of State Brown on this issue and was proud to pass this bill and hope that it would be as successful as it has been. And I want to thank Ms. Miles for her good work in making sure that this idea that was hatched has actually become something that's meaningful and useful for our small businesses, which is what we intended it to do. And thank you to my colleague, Representative Gomberg, for championing this as well. It's just one of those success stories, and we would like for it continue to be such. So thank you for bringing this today and for making sure that we give it that little additional boost and make sure that we can help more small businesses along the way. If there aren't any questions for this panel, yes, Representative Gorsuch.
I have one real picky question. I'm a geographer by trade. And the map showing case locations does not show the full state of Oregon on the south or the east border. I'm just wondering, are there small businesses out there then that aren't showing or what?
I think we may have to defer to Ms. Miles on this one.
You're welcome to join us, Ms. Miles.
Chair McEwen, Representative Gorsuch, the map shows the cases that were opened in 2014 and 2015. At the time that we were in production for this report that you have in front of you, we didn't have the ability to export a high-resolution graphic under certain conditions, and that's why there are limitations. Okay. I hope that in the future we'll be able to have a much better picture of the state, and hopefully we'll have a much better distribution of the cases as well.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. We have one other person signed up to testify. Wendy Johnson, please.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair, for your record, that was Ruth Miles, Small Business Office of Small Business Assistance.
Thank you. We all know Ruth.
Thank you, Ben.
My apologies.
Very helpful.
Thank you, sir.
Keep him around.
Yeah.
Chair McEwen, members of the committee, my name is Wendy Johnson here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. My colleague, Mary Stern, with the Association of Oregon Counties, we work together on this bill on the other side. The League and the Association both support the bill. The specific text of the bill, local governments defined in Section 1, and that would include cities, counties, and special districts. And so we all look forward to the office's expansion to be able to include references to the right local jurisdiction. On the second page of the bill, on the back page, if you have the front and back, sub D allows the agency to direct the business to the right local government, and we think that's really helpful. And then the sub E and sub F allow that's the small business advocate to work with the government and then also make recommendations. So those are three big things, of being able to direct, to work with, and then also make recommendations. And we think those are all going to be helpful to all of our local governments. The League, I forgot to mention, represents 242 cities, and they all have various levels of sophistication. And just to have this ability to direct them to the right place will be helpful. It doesn't usurp the local government's authority to make its decisions and its processes, but it helps to have an advocate to help answer questions and direct them to the right place and to facilitate as they can. So we're supportive of the bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Great. Thank you so much for being here today.
I'm excited. It's gonna be good.
I don't see any questions. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Representative Bentz, you look pensive. Did you have a question?
Pensive. Thank you, Madam Chair. I was only looking pensive because when I look at this, I see no end of work, and much of it we can blame on ourselves for the haystack of regulations and other poorly crafted efforts that we generate in this building. But I don't want to discourage these efforts. Lord knows people need a guide through this labyrinth of stuff that we've created, but there's no end to it. And so I don't think we need maybe 20 or 30 more Ruths if we're going to broaden her duties this way. Just saying.
Thank you. And Ms. Miles, do you mind? I might ask you a question if you don't mind coming back. And it may just clarify part of what Representative Bentz just brought up, and it's a question that I asked earlier. I believe when we passed this bill in 2013, there were two positions available. Those positions are now filled, but we obviously have a need to expand, and it sounds to me as though we may be adding one more position. Is that correct? Or filling one more position that's already been appropriated for? So I wanted to clarify that, if you don't mind.
Of course, Chair McEwen, Representative Bentz.
For the record,
I'm Ruth Miles,
thank you.
Small Business Advocate for Secretary of State, for the record, and thank you for your graciousness and me for getting that before. Yes, so with the original bill came two FTE, one for an advocacy position, which I occupy, and the other for an administrative support position. Both those positions are filled. Out of the 2015 legislative session, we came out with one additional full-time equivalent for an advocacy position. Mm-hmm. We've waited to fill that until we have an idea of the shape of this bill, and waited honestly until our numbers justify having a third person who's doing full-time casework in the office. So depending on what the legislative pleasure is to pass this bill, we would hire accordingly.
Great. Thank you for clarifying that. Any questions for Ms. Miles? All right. Thank you for your good work.
Madam Chair, for me.
Yes, sir.
So we're seeing many of our counties are losing help because of PERS and other things that are driving costs up and staff down. So when I look at this, I see a great demand for that which you would be doing that otherwise at one time might have been done by staffs in towns down through our southern Oregon region and other places. Have you noticed that lack of assistance? I see that there's two paragraphs here that talk about local governments, and I'm just thinking back of what used to be done in many of the small towns I represent, but those people aren't there anymore. Are you now being called into those circumstances to fill in and help out, whereas we might have had city staff doing it before?
Chair McEwen, Representative Bentz, I haven't noticed any distinct increase that I would attribute to cities, counties, or special districts having a decrease in staff that would be available to help businesses. What I can attribute some of the increase in the number of cases that we can't really directly work on currently that are local or federal in nature, mostly local, would be we've done really assertive outreach campaign for this office over the past couple of years that involves an awful lot of trotting around the state and meeting business owners, nonprofit associations, community partners face-to-face so that they know that there is a point of entry to state government for them. I think that the increase in the number of cases that we saw in other categories as well as in that kind of local, those local things that we couldn't really work on, is really due to greater awareness about that sort of ability. We ask business owners to tell us what their challenges are, and we listen to what they say. As you point out, cities and counties may not have the ability to have somebody dedicated to doing that, and so we may be in the position of hearing problems that cities or counties may not have the ability to record in such detail as we do. Does that answer your question, sir?
Follow up. I would just say, in looking at paragraph E and F on the second page of the bill, it appears to me that as soon as cities find out that you're available to assist, you're going to have more work than you can possibly get done. And at least that would be the case with land use planning issues or any number of other issues. Whether you're just a conduit to somebody else, well, that's great. But if you're actually trying to do the work, I don't know how you ever could keep up with the demand, because I see so much of it now in most of the towns I represent. I have about a dozen, and there's many more across the state. So that appears to me what's happening in E and F is you're expanding into the local government realm. And so it's going to be interesting to see what happens. I'm not saying I don't support it. I'll vote for it. But I'm just saying, what a lot of work.
Chair McEwen, Representative Vince, if I may. The office currently works with executive branch agencies to try and find a solution for businesses and nonprofits that have less than 100 employees. We don't necessarily do all of the work ourselves. What we do is facilitate a means to an end. So this is very much the work of an ombudsman. This is an opportunity, I think, for cities, for counties, to have an augmented listening program and someone who can help. But that doesn't mean that we'll be able to do all of the work ourselves. We'll require the assistance of the cities.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Oh. I'm sorry. Representative Gorsuch had a question.
Sorry.
I'm sorry, Ms. Miles.
Thank you, Madam Chair. With some of the things that Representative Gomberg was describing earlier, would it make any sense, or do you already tie in, you know, kind of basic referral information to something like 411? Does that help you at all?
Chair McEwen, Representative Gorsuch, we have a very rich referral network. We don't necessarily make a lot of use of 411, but because we're working with businesses for the most part, rather than individual constituents or citizens of the state. But we continue to develop an institutionalized knowledge base through the use of our case management system, so that it's not dependent on one person or two people knowing the answers or who to contact or what department, division, phone number, hyperlink to use for a particular problem. So we continue to expand institutionalized knowledge base so that that will be available in the future.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any further questions? I think now we are finished. Thank you, Ms. Martin. I am going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1583 and open a work session on Senate Bill 1583. Representative Davis.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 1583A to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Davis moves Senate Bill 1583A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any comments? Clerk, will you take the roll, please?
Representative Benz?
Aye.
Representative Hack?
Aye.
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Representative
McClain? Aye.
Vice Chair Gorsuch?
Yes.
Vice Chair Davis?
Aye.
Chair McEwen?
Aye. The motion carries. I believe Representative Gomberg may choose to carry this if there are no objections. We'll assign it to Representative Gomberg. And we will close the work session on Senate Bill 1583A. And two more pieces of business we have to do today. And we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1543A and turn to Mr. Brennan to give us the update.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 1543 comes to us with a vote of 28-0, directs the Oregon Tourism Commission to distribute one half of revenues from the sale of wine country vehicle registration plates for the purpose of wine and culinary tourism promotion, in collaboration with the Oregon Wine Board and relevant regional wine industry associations. It permits the Oregon Transportation Department to issue wine country license plates to vehicles operated by the board, and would have take effect upon passage and signature by the governor. There's a minimal fiscal impact, no revenue impact, and no amendments, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Brennan. We have four people signed up to testify. I'd like to call up first Mr. Jarman, Mr. Donovan, and Mr. Patacoli.
Well done. That's what happened, is it?
That does not happen often.
Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Chair McEwen, members of the committee, I'm Dan Jarman here today representing the Oregon Wine Growers Association. Thank you very much for scheduling a hearing and work session on Senate Bill 1543. Also, special thanks to Senator Jackie Winters, sponsors of our legislation. Unfortunately, she can't be here today, as most of you know. She was the co-author of this original legislation in 2011 that established the Oregon Wine Country License Plate, along with Representative Kevin Cameron, who's now at the Marion County Commission. We do greatly appreciate that she understands and supports what we're trying to accomplish with this modified legislation. So special thanks to her. We've met with all of you and talked about this legislation, so we promised to be brief today. Let me present to you or introduce to you two presenters. First, Michael Donovan, who is a former Oregon Wine Board Chair and former President of the Oregon Wine Growers Association. He's currently still a member of the Wine Growers Association Board, Managing Director of Irvine Family Vineyards, and was involved in the 2011 legislation. Michael is going to go over what we're trying to accomplish with this bill. And then John Patacoli, who is owner of Red Hawk Vineyards and Winery outside of Salem, over in the West Salem area. He is an OWA member, but today he is here representing the Willamette Valley Wineries Association, one of the 13 winery associations in the state that supports the legislation. So I'll turn it over to Mr. Donovan. Thank you.
Chairman McCallan.
It's McEwen, okay. Everybody gets it wrong.
Chairman
You're one
McEwen.
Of many.
For the record, my name is Michael Donovan. I am the managing director of Irvine Family Vineyards in Ashland, Oregon. And as Mr. Jarman has indicated, I am a member of the Oregon Wine Board and a member of the Oregon Wine Growers Association currently. Also, I'm the current president of the Southern Oregon Winery Association. But the Oregon Wine Growers Association has really targeted this initiative as one of their lead legislative priorities for this year. The OWA is a statewide membership organization. It represents Oregon wineries and vineyard owners. The sister organization, the Oregon Wine Board, is a semi-independent state agency responsible for marketing and promoting Oregon wine. And we have more than a dozen regional winery organizations that work similarly to benefit their wineries and vineyards throughout the state. Since this bill was created in 2011, I had the privilege of working alongside David Adelsheim and Angie Morris from Travel Salem in terms of putting this bill together. It was actually the concept. We give credit to Angie Morris for actually coming up with the concept. And we feel that in passing that in 2011, it has done a lot to bring people's awareness to our industry, and in fact, it is the only such plate anywhere in the United States that features prominently a wine country region. As you may have known, the number of Oregon wineries has grown substantially from about 463 to nearly 700 today. The industry's economic impact in the state is now $3.3 billion annually, with more than 22,000 jobs created throughout the state. Wine-related tourism contributes about $208 million to our Oregon economy each year. So as the industry has grown, so has direct-to-consumer sales from tasting rooms. Therefore, increasing the industry very much is in favor of, you know, generating more tourism to come to our state and bringing more customers to wine country is very critical to the future success of our industry. We have, however, since 2011, heard numerous responses from industry members around the state who felt it there needed to be some changes made in this bill. We first of all want to state that the Oregon Wine Board has a very positive relationship with Travel Oregon. We partner with them on a number of important initiatives. They are probably our closest partnership in the state government with whom we work. We feel that they have done a very good job in taking this difficult program on in terms of, you know, having to make these decisions on allocations. As you may know, the legislation was originally established with a $30 per plate surcharge with the monies going to Travel Oregon. And Travel Oregon would disperse those surcharge programs through two programs. One would be a grant program for wine and culinary tourism competitive matching grants. And I want to state that we think that program works fine. We're very supportive of that part of the program. It's the other half of the program that that was dedicated for general tourism that goes to local tourism agencies representing the various wine regions. That is actually based on the amount of vineyard acreage planted in those regions. But local winery associations and industry members have felt that they were not perhaps as enfranchised in this process from the very beginning as they maybe would have liked many times. Not to say that there were not winery representatives, but the major winery associations throughout the state were really not consulted in a close fashion in terms of how these funds might be spent to further market Oregon wine. One of the things that at the Oregon Wine Board that we work very hard on to avoid is any kind of overlap or duplication of funds going out to promote the Oregon wine, whether we're traveling to New York or we're going to Atlanta or Houston or Chicago. I mean, it's important that there's not another precious amount of dollars going to do the same thing by another group. We've always, one of the things that the Oregon wine industry has really accomplished in the last few years, the last 10 years really, is to try to collaborate as much as possible with one another throughout the state of Oregon and to make sure that we're speaking with one voice. We are proposing actually in 1543A, really only making two changes to the current law. Those that would clarify that the destination marketing organizations, the DMOs, should spend their programmed monies on promoting wine and culinary tourism just like they would in the grant process. This was really the intent of the legislation by many of us who were involved with it. It is obviously a wine country license plate, and we feel that we will do a very good job in working alongside the DMOs and Travel Oregon in bringing the right kind of visitor to our tasting rooms and to the rest of the state to benefit from. We would also like to ask that in order to kind of cement this collaboration with the winery associations, that Travel Oregon would put together and spell out how that collaboration would work through rulemaking. Our suggestion would be that the winery associations may designate someone from their organization, say from the Willamette Valley Winery Association, to serve on one of those DMOs. That way we would ensure that there's close, two-way conversations going on between the DMOs and the winery associations. Other than those two changes, we seek no other changes to the program. The OWA anticipates that this modified program will ensure that the limited dollars are best utilized to promote effective and collaborative wine and culinary tourism initiatives. Thank you very much. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Thank you, sir. I think we'll complete the testimony and then open it for questions. So, welcome. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Patacoli. I'm the owner and the winemaker at Red Hawk Vineyard and Winery right here in West Salem, just a few miles from here. I'm representing today as the immediate past president the Willamette Valley Wineries Association, the largest such association in the state. We have approximately 210 winery members, and we are one of 13 such organizations, the largest, that has signed a letter that you will have if you don't already, in support of this legislation. And the reason our board voted unanimously to support this, this looks like roughly $150,000 to $200,000 a year that's going to be generated, and that's a tidy sum of money. But when you think about what our neighbors to the north spend on marketing their wine region, and especially our neighbors to the south, this is a very small sum of money compared to the amount of money being spent by our competitors. So we really need to be smarter and more focused, more collaborative on what we're doing. We can't duplicate our efforts when we have such a small sum of money to spend. We need to be smarter. than our competitors. And we think that these minor changes to this bill will help us do that and become smarter, more collaborative than we already are, and a little more focused, not only strategically, but frankly, tactically as well, in order to accomplish some of our goals. So thank you.
Good. Thank you. Questions for this panel? Yes, Vice Chair Gorsuch.
Yeah, I have a couple of questions. So currently, is the 50% that goes to local tourism boards in the region, right?
Madam Chair, Representative Gorsuch, yes. So one of the things that is written in the law is that it's only those travel organizations that represent wine country.
Right.
Travel Oregon went through a process of identifying vineyard acres throughout the state because that's the basis for the calculation. Does it figure it out then where these various wine regions are, and then assign four different regions to those areas based on vineyard acres?
And so if we were to take that money from them, which is what it sounds like the bill does, how would that impact those four regional tourism groups?
Madam Chair, Representative Gorsuch, there's no money that is going away. That is not in this A version of the legislation. It does not change the distribution formula at all. It doesn't take the money away from Travel Oregon, which disperses the money. All it does is two things. It says that when you spend the money, and again, we're not asking for any approval process on spending the money, but when you spend the money, it needs to be spent on wine and culinary tourism programs.
Okay. Within each of those regions.
That's correct. Okay. And then, again, secondly, just being part of that collaborative process through rulemaking that Travel Oregon would undertake. So. Thank you for letting me clarify that.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any further questions?
Madam Chair, one more
yes,
bit
Mr.
of clarification.
Brown.
There is one more provision, very minor one in the bill that you may have read toward the end. The Oregon Wine Board has a car, part of the motor pool. Since it is a semi-independent state agency, the staff was hoping to get a wine country plate on that motor pool car. ODOT said can't do that without some statutory clarification. So there is some language in there that allows the wine board motor pool car. These are the folks who travel around the state talking to the winery regions and promoting the industry to have an Oregon wine country plate. So,
Mr. Jarman, I'm curious, as someone who's used motor pool cars in the past, and we just get the one that they give us on any given day, is there a car assigned to this?
Madam Chair, there is a car assigned to the wine bureau or the wine board.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for the clarification. I think that seems very appropriate. Questions or comments? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
We have one other signed up to testify today, Mr. Bill Cross. Could you join us? Welcome to our committee, sir.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Bill Cross, and I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Destination Marketing Organizations, which represent the kind of Convention Visitor Bureau destination marketing groups. They range from chambers to agencies of cities around the state. And their organization opposes the current bill. There is no question that after having gone through this process of working with OWA on the legislation, that I think the provisions requiring greater collaboration between the two industries is something that makes considerable sense to all parties. I think all parties want to see this money used to its best and highest extent, and to the degree that there may be redundancies or missed opportunities, ODMO would like to work with the wine growers, both their local and local associations and their state wine board, to help improve that. Our concern in the bill is the redirection of the monies for the portion that was originally allocated to the regions for tourism promotion. And in 2011, when the bill passed, championed by Senator Winters, the legislative body decided to put 50% into specific wine and culinary tourism promotions and 50% into the regional tourism. And in part, I think it was to ensure that all regions would benefit to some degree, because all regions do have wine assets, and are very, and those assets are very important to them. The thought, though, being that there would be opportunities, perhaps at the regional tourism level, to use those monies for whatever was deemed there again the most effective use of those monies for promoting tourism, because on the other side of promoting wine and culinary tourism is bringing tourists to a general area, and while they're there, they take advantage of those assets. So that was part of the discussion, and the Oregon Destination Marketing organizations think it's premature, since the contracts were just issued last fall. One series of grants has been awarded. Another series is about ready, or sometime later this year will be awarded. And I think we would feel better if there were a couple years of sort of experience with this before a policy change of that significance were entertained in the legislative body. Do you have any questions?
I have a question.
Yes, Vice Chair Gorsuch.
So, Mr. Cross, did you say that there's only been one set of contracts? Is that right?
Madam Chair, Representative Gorsuch, that is correct. Evidently, the by the time the funds started coming through, because it took a year or two to get the license plates designed, mm-hmm. manufactured out there, collections coming in, that it was earlier this year that the Oregon Tourism put out grant RFPs and then awarded the four regions it's a rolling two-year, or not rolling, but I mean, I think it's a two-year contract based on their strategies.
Okay. Follow-up.
So is the $240,000 that's listed on our sheets here, is that just from one time around? Because it says here the first 3 years of the program have provided approximately $240,000.
Madam Chair, Representative Gorsuch, that may be the total that has been accumulated so far for the program, but I would defer to someone else in the audience that may have a better answer.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're very welcome. Further questions?
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I think we have somebody in the audience that has that information. I would like to know what that is.
Is there someone else who would like to testify today?
Oh, but Mr. Jarman.
Mr. Jarman. You're welcome to stay, or you may step, whichever you prefer.
I'm fine. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Cross.
Oh, wow.
All right.
But it's so much fun up here.
What the heck?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Jarman.
The answer to the question, that $240,000 that's mentioned in the materials, the plate was enacted by the legislature in 2011. In 2012, they started selling the plates. And so that $30 surcharge, the revenues accrued for 2012, 2013, and 2014. Once you took out the administrative cost for the plate, that $240,000 is what was left for the program monies. Right. To mm-hmm. the DMOs. So roughly 3 years of monies, although you need to remember there was admin costs in that. Mm-hmm. There's another $240,000 that's those competitive grants that we talked about. And if I could also mention something about the sort of the need for the legislation now, we're expecting the next round of funding to be released from Travel Oregon to the DMOs in July of 2017. That means in the spring of 2017 and the winter of 2017, that's when the DMOs will be doing their planning for how they will spend that second round of money. That's why it's important to pass legislation now, so we can have be part of those discussions in 2017 in the early part of the year, and hopefully work with them to put together these wine and culinary tourism initiatives that can really move the needle on tourism.
Okay. Thank you. Yes, Representative McClain.
Well, in the language that you just referenced, it doesn't say to me that it just has to say wine and culinary tour, that in that you could add other things to whatever you're promoting.
Madam Chair, Representative McLean, you're right. I mean, there is no definition of wine and culinary tourism. And, you know, obviously Travel Oregon in its grant making in this area has given some sort of direction. Mm-hmm. I think it's very flexible. There's not going to be a wine and culinary police out there looking at every line item of what's spent. But I think it just sends a very general message that these limited dollars that the DMOs have, they should work with the wine industry to put together initiatives that really can promote the industry.
Great. Thank you. Any further questions? I believe we have completed our testimony. And on that note, I am going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1543A and open a work session on Senate Bill 1543A. And I will turn to Vice Chair Davis.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 1543A to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Davis has moved Senate Bill 1543A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further comments? Clerk, would you, Representative McLean?
Well, I'm always very impressed that anybody who can get a license plate bill through here successfully, and there have been two now that I've known of in my short tenure here. And it seems to me only fair that when you've got a, you know, a wine plate license plate, and you've got an industry that started, you know, that process, that they're going to get to benefit from that. And 50% is benefit, but I think that direction and more talking sounds very positive. And I don't believe that it doesn't mean that the region is not going to benefit from that particular type of advertisement or that type of work of getting folks there for culinary wine tours and everything else that's in the region. So I really don't see it as a block or as somehow hurting the region. I think it's just, you know, going to bring more conversation, more working together, and more figuring out how to use the money well. And the industry that brought the money to the table, I think, has a right to be there and really discuss what's going on in that region with the rest of the folks and the rest of the highlights and the rest of the different types of tourism activities that are in that area.
Thank you. Vice Chair Gorsuch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I see both sides of this. I can certainly see where you would, as my colleague just said, want that money to be focused very much on the wine and culinary aspects of things. On the other hand, we've only been, essentially, we're going through one iteration of this policy. And it seems to me that it may be premature to change this at this point until we see how things work with, you know, this go-round and then the next go-round before coming to a policy conclusion. So that's all I have.
Thank you. Any other comments? Clerk, will you call the roll, please?
Representative Bentz?
Aye.
Representative Hack?
Aye.
Representative Lively?
Aye.
Representative McLean?
Aye.
Vice Chair Gorsuch?
No.
Vice Chair Davis?
Aye.
Chair McHugh?
Aye. The motion carries. I believe Representative Reed is one of the sponsors on the House side, so unless you have any other... Oh, Representative Hack. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Would you like to carry this bill?
Sure.
I'm getting ahead of myself. I'm on another bill.
No worries.
I'm going to assign this gladly to Representative Hack. Thank you so much, Representative Hack. Please share passage of this with Senator Winters, and I know she's not here this session, but give her our best, and you can express to her our congratulations that her bill is passed, and you'll be carrying it for us.
Okay.
Thank you. And on that note, we will close the work session on 1543A, and we will open a work session on Senate Bill 1589, the Credit Enhancement Fund. And I'll turn to Mr. Brennan to enlighten us again, please.
Oh, yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 1589 modifies the definition of qualified business eligible for loans or credit guarantees from the Credit Enhancement Fund to include existing or proposed businesses that are located in Oregon that will produce substantial benefits for the state. The measure has an emergency clause, so it would take effect upon passage. We heard this bill last Wednesday. We still have no amendment. It has a minimal fiscal and a minimal revenue impact. Just for reference and reminder, the Senate floor vote was 21-8, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Brennan. And I will turn to Vice Chair Gorsuch.
Madam Chair, I move that we move Senate Bill 1589 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Vice Chair Gorsuch. Move Senate Bill 1589 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Are there comments? Yes, Vice Chair Davis.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be voting against Senate Bill 1589. While I understand the reasoning, and I think the presentation provided a very good background on the Credit Enhancement Fund and the challenge with having such a limited definition of what a qualified business can be, seems to me that we may be going from, or not maybe, but we are going from one extreme to the other here, where we have many policies and programs in this state that are targeted at either small businesses, rural businesses, or emerging businesses that can use credit support. The definitional change in this bill to any business that will produce substantial benefits for this state is just too broad, and doesn't limit it to, frankly, those industries that we would like to provide some assistance to at this time.
Thank you, Vice Chair Davis. Further comments? I'm not going to say anything. Seeing none, Clerk, will you call the roll, please?
Representative Fentz?
No.
Representative Hack?
No.
Representative Wiley?
Aye.
Representative McLean?
Aye.
Vice Chair Gorsuch?
Yes.
Vice Chair Davis?
No.
Chair McHugh?
Aye. And the motion carries. And now I believe that Representative Reed would be interested in carrying this bill. So we will assign it to him, please. And I believe that completes our agenda for this session.
We need a party.
It hasn't really even been on the radar, but we have another few days, so stay tuned.
There you go.
I will look to Mr. Brennan. Mr. Brennan, I think we are complete. I had considered doing some informational hearings. Because of the fluid nature of the next few days, I've been advised that maybe not scheduling things would be more appropriate as we begin to wind down this short session. So we will be canceling our agenda for Wednesday and Friday, and hopefully you'll use your time effectively while you're here. I'm sure you all will. And unless there's anything else for the good of the order today, yes, Vice Chair Davis.
I'd just like to extend a thank you on behalf of the committee to Patrick for your very able work in the interim. I have to say, of all the committee administrators that I've worked with, your regular updates that you provide and the work you do on behalf of the committee is just above all and very much appreciated. So thank you.
Yes.
And I will concur, Mr. Brennan, it's been a delight once again working with you, and we will look forward to another session another day when some of us hopefully will cross paths again. And thank you so much for your good work. It's the long session was, it was all stellar. The committee services, the administration up there does a fantastic job, and we stumped to get you on our committee, and we were delighted you were assigned.
Mission accomplished.
And it served us in very good stead. Thank you so much.
I enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
Anything else?
It's a good bunch to work with.
All right. On that note, we're adjourned.
Thank you. Sorry.
Mission accomplished. Mission accomplished.